Welcome to the HJ Talks About Abuse podcast. In this podcast, we talk about sexual abuse cases in the hope it will assist listeners in openly discussing topics which have been ignored for too long. This podcast is brought to you by the abuse team at Hugh James. We are lawyers, so we do tend to speak about the legal aspects of abuse cases, but we aren't too shy to speak up about the broader issues faced by survivors too. Hello, podcast listeners. This is Sam Barker from Hugh James, and I'm joined by Alan Collins.
Hello.
So in this podcast, we're going to talk about, well, I guess we should introduce the podcast as well. We always talk about issues in relation to developments in the law and also things that happen in society and news stories in relation to anything that's, you know, in the realm of sexual abuse or exploitation. And many people would know that female genital mutilation, which is often referred to as FGM or female circumcision, is illegal here in the UK and in many other countries. But there was recent media and also a BBC news story about the practice of male circumcision and where this fits in with those kind of laws. So we thought we would speak about that today. And Alan, look, I guess I'll pass it over to you. What's your views on all of this?
Well, thank you, Sam. So I hope everyone is sitting comfortably because it's a rather unusual subject for us to discuss, I guess. But because of what you read in the news about male circumcision in the Philippines, and that seemed to have coincided with the BBC programme on male circumcision, we thought, well, let's have a look at the issue of, is it actually lawful? So male circumcision is the removal of the foreskin. It's, as I understand it, a procedure that goes back, you know, to very, very ancient times. And I guess for many of us, it's something that we haven't really sort of thought about. But what you saw in the news, Sam, was interesting. I think that was some boys in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Being circumcised.
The issue in that case, of course, was that these are boys in their young teens, you know, 13, 14 years old, you know, undergoing circumcision at a very late stage of development and often in circumstances where there's not proper medical care that follows it, and it's not done in the most hygienic of circumstances. And that, again, was for cultural reasons within certain tribes and things like that in the Philippines. It had been highlighted.
Yeah, the BBC program raised this question, well, is the practice actually lawful? I watched the program because I knew we were going to be possibly making a podcast, given what you read in the news about the Philippines. So circumcision goes back, as I mentioned just now, to very ancient times. It's traditionally undertaken as a mark of cultural identity or religious importance. There is an argument that there's a perceived health benefit in that it helps to improve hygiene or reduce the risk of infection. It's, I think, generally understood a practice that we find amongst Muslims and Jews, and doing a little bit of research, I see that the religious justification for Jews comes from Genesis 17, which states that circumcision is a covenant with God and all boys should be circumcised on the eighth day. And we see that in other communities, such as the indigenous communities in Australia, circumcision has been carried out as a practice, again, from ancient times. It seems an important initiation rite, and basically it's all about giving the boy his identity. So, you know, it's a very highly valued part of his identity. So we can see that circumcision in the 21st century continues to play a significant part in the social and cultural identity of many communities.
And I guess that's also starkly contrasted with the issue of female circumcision, which has been rightfully outlawed in a lot of countries due to the significant health risk.
This is where we're going to come on to this argument about whether male circumcision is lawful, because the practice of female circumcision in some communities, again, it's part of initiation, it's part of culture and so on. So for us, we might think, well, you know, this is wrong, it's bizarre, it's crazy. But there is a crossover so that, yeah, many forms of FGM have been outlawed because of the damage that's caused and so on. But in some parts of the world is a very common practice. I think we found on a UN website that worldwide the number of girls and women that have undergone genital mutilation is estimated between 100 and 140 million, with 3 million young girls undergoing this each year. You know, it's an astonishing number. So, you know, so this begs the question, I think, well, if FGM is outlawed, why isn't male circumcision?
Well, I think one of the big issues that comes into this is that society somewhere does have to draw a line between where religious practices or practices that are implemented within a religion, you know, are one, unjustified, and two, are more harmful than what they're trying to achieve. That's clearly been the case with female genital mutilation. There's, first of all, one of the main criticisms of it, of course, is that it is specifically designed to reduce the sexual pleasure of women during sex, and that there's no health benefit. In fact, it causes serious health issues. And, you know, I guess the mere name of it itself, referring to it as genital mutilation rather than circumcision, really does speak for itself.
Well, maybe this is where the answer to the legality question comes in, because baby boys being circumcised are not consenting. They're too young to consent, and the parents of the boys are the ones giving the consent for the circumcision to take place. So the argument is in respect of all of this, where boys can't consent to part of their anatomy being removed. It must be an assault because it's an interference with their body, but the crossover is there with FGM because, you know, little girls are being mutilated as well. But the counter argument is going to be, well, the parents have given consent to their sons being circumcised, but they're giving that consent on the basis that it's to their son's benefit.
Yeah.
Whereas you can't see any benefit to the younger girl being, you know, cut. You know, that's been done for the man's benefit, so to speak. It's been done for men's benefit, whereas with a boy being circumcised, it's been done for his benefit. I think that's where the important difference is, and that's why I would come to the conclusion that you have to distinguish between the reasons, and if you do make the distinction, you come to, I would say, a logical answer to the question, is male circumcision lawful?
Yeah.
I would say it is lawful. Yes, at first blush, when you think about it, you know, that must be the sort of on the boy's body because he hasn't consented to it, and you should wait until he's of an age before you carry out the procedure so he can make an informed decision about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, understand that argument. But when you look at the difference between the two, there is a clear difference because mum and dad are agreeing to their son being circumcised because they see it as to his advantage, to his benefit.
Yeah.
As he becomes a part of their community, part of the wider family and so on.
I guess my view is the law needs to step in where things are being done that are really harmful to a person that they don't necessarily have any control over, and where, you know, it's done under the pretense of some sort of religious activity. You know, for example, what jumps to mind here is Jehovah's Witnesses and blood transfusions and refusal to engage in blood transfusions for religious reasons. Now, people have the freedom to engage in their religion and practice their religion, etc. But at some point, somebody's got to step in and say, well, look, if the parents are refusing to give the child a blood transfusion and that child will die on religious reasons, then the law must step in for the greater good. And I think that applies in the circumstance of female genital mutilation, which the law is rightly outlawed. And, you know, that's a departure from the UK case of R.V. Brown, a House of Lords decision that says, and I quote, ritual circumcision, tattooing, ear piercing and violent activities, including boxing, are lawful activities. But Alan, I think that the feeding into your point there about male circumcision, was it not the outcome of that BBC program that the doctor, or, you know, their expert medical person who was on there, found that there wasn't any health problems with the practice of male circumcision?
Negligently. The surgeon was saying that he couldn't, as I understand, he couldn't see the difference between FGM and male circumcision because you're cutting a young person's body for no medical benefit. So I can see where the surgeon was coming from, but I think it's, from a legal perspective, it's too simplistic to say that if you go and circumcise a baby boy, that it must be illegal. I think if the parents can point to the benefits outweighing perceived harm or real risk of harm, it's difficult to say that the son's human rights have been infringed in some way, or that an injury has been inflicted that amounts to an assault. Because, as I said, I think if the parents can demonstrate that there's an objective benefit to their son undergoing the procedure, it's completely different to FGM. So, as I said, I think when you look at it at first blush, you can see where the surgeon's coming from. What's the difference? But I think if you analyse it, there is an important difference. FGM is not, in any shape or form, I don't think,
beneficial.
Yeah. To the girl. It's being done for somebody else's benefit. It's being done for the benefit of men, whereas the male circumcision is being done for the boy's benefit in the eyes of his parents and their community, because it introduces them to that part of the family, that wider community.
Yeah. So, look, thanks for everybody listening today. The reason we're talking about this topic was to, I guess, illustrate ways in which the law can apply differently to ostensibly similar things. But if you look at it and you get down into the nuts and bolts of it all, you can see exactly why that kind of decision process indeed transpired. So thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Sam.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of HJ Talks About Abuse. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you would like to speak to Alan or I about something you have heard this week, or even if you would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, please do get in touch at aboutabuse@hjtalks.co.uk.